Thank you, Siv, for inviting me. Well, hydrocephalus isn't what I usually work on. I usually work on pediatric brain injury. And I asked Siv, why me? And he said, because you've written a lot of papers on brain properties. And I said, okay. But I thought this morning and this afternoon about the concept of modeling in this session is actually bimodal. So some of you have animal models where you're inducing hydrocephalus and you're studying its evolution, its cellular effects. Others of you, especially this morning, have mathematical models where you're trying to make predictions and understand mechanisms associated with the induction and resolution of hydrocephalus. And so my work in pediatric head injury, traumatic brain injury, actually spans both those kinds of models. I have large animal models for traumatic brain injury, and I do study those types of things that we're discussed this afternoon in terms of the effects of the disease, or in my case, the injury. But today I'm going to be restricting my attention to talking about some of the experimental measurements that we've made that are useful for computational and mathematical models for hydrocephalus, specifically about properties of brain tissue. And then I started thinking about it, and actually over lunch asked Per, you know, about the age of the patients that get hydrocephalus, and I felt it was important to also throw in data that we have about from infants, human infants, about skull and suture, because if you only talk about the brain when you're talking about the compliant container and you have a young child with a compliant skull case, then we need to be talking about that as well. And then at the very end, I've thrown in just a couple of slides about modeling the interaction between brain and skull. Might not be as important for hydrocephalus, but in particular, we've done some work about the relationship of the brain in terms of its ability to extrude outside the foramen magnum in human volunteers just in full flexion and extension. And I think that's also an important thing to be thinking about when you're modeling the container and how rigid is the container that you're actually modeling. So I don't have big messages for you for modeling hydrocephalus, but more importantly, I think I'd like to raise some concerns ask you to consider some things. So when I think about mechanical properties, this is actually not a pen, okay. When I think about mechanical properties, and I'm talking to a group that doesn't necessarily measure mechanical properties, I think it's important to state that the goal is really a biophidelic or a lifelike description of living tissue that can be used in computational models of the head. And so it's important to consider what the stiffness is of the materials. When in traumatic brain injury, it's important to know the yield or the point at which something that might be elastic and able to return to its initial condition, at what point does it yield and it undergoes plastic deformation and it will not return to its original condition. Also important more in traumatic brain injury would be the ultimate stress and strain. At what point does fracture occur in the skull? And functional issues are relevant to you, and I'll end with that as well. We're very concerned in the deformation thresholds, and for you it may be stress thresholds, beyond which the function changes in the brain tissue. So we're looking at thresholds in traumatic brain injury that are associated with tissue deformations, that are associated with changes in cerebral blood flow locally as well as globally. We're looking at axonal injury occurring either transiently by beta-APP staining or more permanently by staining neurofilaments, as well as some additional considerations including cell death. So those would be functional thresholds. What sort of key, when you go and predict hydrocephalus and you predict regional stresses in the brain, what sort of functional changes happen in the brain? And so I'll come back to that at the very end and just indicate that I think that we haven't really talked about those in this setting, and I think it's an important thing to consider. And really by a discussion between the experimental models, those who have experimental models, and those who are creating the computational and mathematical models, that's the region where you can try and come up with, through collaboration, some of the functional thresholds. I think some important considerations that as you're trying to evaluate material properties is whether or not the condition produces large deformations or small deformations, occurring at fast rates or slow rates. Is age important? Species, is that important? Many of you have animal models, so when someone does material testing, Is it relevant to your rat model if the testing was done in another species, for example? Are there regional differences? So if you're very concerned about the pressure that's developing in a certain part of the brain tissue, is brain-brain everywhere that you look? Are the properties the same? And do you need to consider the directional properties of the brain tissue? And that's something that Dick had brought up earlier today. So the answer is different if I think about hydrocephalus than if I think about traumatic brain injury. So because my data was pretty much gathered with a attention towards answering these questions in terms of traumatic brain injury, my answers were very large deformations that are occurring at very high rates. So a typical head injury event in my animal model takes place over the course of about 10 to 15 milliseconds from the head in one position to an inertial rotation that has an ending position without any impact at all, but an ending position just 10 to 15 milliseconds later. So very rapid. Yes? Pardon me? Oh, deformations are above 30% strain. Okay. So that's an important question. Age, in my lab we're looking at pediatric brain injuries, so I'd focus my attention on infants, toddlers, and more recently we've started to get at kind of school-age children a little bit too from Department of Transportation. Species, we've looked at properties in rat, pig, and human. We are interested in regional differences in anisotropy. I'll be talking mostly about brain today, a little bit about the skull and suture data because I think it's relevant to this group, and very little bit, but a little bit, about the boundary conditions. So because I'm going to be presenting data from other species, I think, and age, I am not a neuroscientist, so I'm a bioengineer, so I like for this to be solved by other people. So I use established markers in terms of developmental timelines, and in terms of the porcine data, which is a lot of what I'll be showing you today, newborn piglets are equivalent, have many similarities to humans that are less than 1 month of age. I've also studied four-week-old pigs. They're like toddlers. Their properties were no different than adult pig brains that I got from the slaughterhouse. I can't say that human toddlers are exactly like adult. In fact, they have some differences. I have made some measurements in humans at that human tissue at that age, and there's some differences. The previous neurodevelopmental work, references are provided, and you can take a look at that. But we've done excised tissue. But I will also show, and so there are some differences, as we talked about in Dick's presentation, between studying a perfused brain in an intact skull and taking out a piece of brain and studying it. And so I think those are very important differences, but I will also be presenting some data where we open up the skull and actually indent directly on living brain tissue, albeit it's going to be the cortical surface, we reflect the dura, so really on the pia arachnoid surface, I suppose you could say. And then we sacrifice the animal, repeat the experiments in situ, and then finally we scoop the brain out from that animal, put it out on a lubricated surface, and study the tissues there, because I think that these boundary conditions as well as living versus dead are very important. But the first bit of data that I'm going to show you is all parallel plate properties. Very long ago we used to do oscillatory experiments, and now we do a simple stress relaxation. Plate moves to a given displacement, that's held, we wait until steady state is reached. We're going to be talking about preconditioning, which is repeat that until your results are consistent. Does that actually damage the tissue? Does that not damage the tissue? From a mechanical engineer point of view, one usually goes and preconditions materials until you get reliable and reproducible results. In the setting of a biological material, on a one-time event when something happens, like a traumatic brain injury, I'm not sure that's the right answer. You may want your unpreconditioned tissue material properties. And as I mentioned, shear strains that we use are from 2.5 to 50%. Actually, yes, from 2.5 to 50%. So we did look first at... It's actually... It was so long ago. Up to 1 hertz, but I don't think it was more than 1 hertz. I think so. It's low, not at all like Dick's. Okay. The truth is I have to read my own papers to remember. So the ramp right here is about 20 to 60 milliseconds for this for these stress relaxation tests. Okay. So basically we did an entire test, And then we wanted to look to see after 50% strain, did we see any rearrangement looking just at H&E? Do we see any changes in the properties? Are the properties even reproducible, the measurements? If we go up to 50% and then return and do another test again at 5% after we've done this whole battery of tests, are those tests comparable? And they were very comparable. There's no significant difference at 5% strain in the stiffness of the material, whether we did all the way up to 50% or it was its first naive test. So we feel that tissue integrity is maintained. And then we also... out of the brain. Dead tissue. Out of the brain. And we're very careful about...
Recently dead.
Less than 5 hours.
Okay. Have you been able to repeat the strain, say 10 times?
Yes. So I'll be very specific about that. Yes. And it's not the same in the first and the 10th time, or in my case, the first and the 6th time. Okay. We identified that actually when we fit the stress relaxation data from a 5% experiment, 5% strain experiment, we fit it. We simulated it using a finite element model, and then to fit the properties, and then we asked the model to predict a large strain at 50%, and the model actually over-predicted the stress. So the actual stress measured was considerably lower, and this indicates that it's a nonlinear material. Okay, so the material is nonlinear, and we really have to be very careful about how we're going to fit the properties and make sure that we have a constitutive property representation that allows for a nonlinear description. Question? Okay. We fit the parameters. I'm sorry. This was a fifth-order Maxwell simulation. Yeah, sorry. That's okay. So we concluded from this little foray that we need to be, for traumatic brain injury, we need to actually have a model that could handle large deformations that was nonlinear because we were demonstrating strain softening in our experimental work that one could implement in a commercial finite element analysis program, and it had to be robust enough that when we tested the tissue in other modes, we got a consistent response with those tissue properties. And so the material model that we've had good luck with is an Ogden hyperelastic model that's been modified to include dissipation. So this is basically the strain energy function here, and this is the nonlinear component, the dissipation component here, and alpha would be the nonlinear factor. And we had to make sure that actually this dissipation component was really dependent on time and not dependent on strain, and that the nonlinear factor alpha was dependent on strain only and not on time. And we did confirm that in experiments, and I'm not going to belabor that because I want the cup of coffee as well. We make it a function of time.
We don't integrate out.
It's the strain energy function, so yes, we do. This is the strain energy function, right. So the lambdas are the nonlinearity coefficient, basically. Who asked the question? For the nonlinear with strain, it's only dependent on it expresses the strain magnitude nonlinearity, the strain softening. Okay. And when we switched to Abacus and said ANSYS, and now when we implement this model, we get good agreement between the predicted and the experimental data. And this was, again, with the model fit at 5% data, then can we predict the others? What was alpha for these? What?
What was the value of alpha?
The value of alpha? I don't remember. I should have brought my paper. Somebody else brought mine. That was good. And then what we did is we looked at, independently, we performed some compression experiments, and actually Carol Miller's in Australia had done some compression experiments, and it was, I said, what a wonderful idea. Yes. So he also did tension experiments, which are really difficult to do in gloppy brain tissue. I'm not quite sure how he managed to do that. But actually we got good prediction of the stress using that material model that we developed in shear on our compression data. So that was... We were pleased with that. But then we really wanted to go on and develop an expression for different regions, different ages, all kinds of different directions to look at anisotropy, because the hypothesis would be that if we did this test and we did the test on the tissue in different regions, if it was isotropic, we should get the same results in the different directions. So we used rectangular samples. We looked at infant tissue, and because the infant, the piglet brains were small enough, we actually used a mixed gray-white matter from the corona radiata section with some cortex in there. And then in adult tissue, we were able to get much cleaner sections, and we looked at gray matter in the thalamus. We also looked in the cortex. We looked at white matter in the corona radiata, corpus callosum, and now we've done brainstem as well. And to just briefly go over the results, there is a difference in the stiffness. This is the mu component here. And it's this is the hyperelastic rate-dependent component. And it was very different, significantly different. And in fact, Dick found that the white matter was stiffest. And I find that white matter is least stiff. And again, that's a difference, you know, in our two techniques, and it'd be interesting to, we were talking during one of the breaks, it would be interesting to get together and figure out why we get different results. Gray matter we find that's isotropic, directionally independent, and corona radiata and corpus callosum, we find directional differences, which wasn't surprising, given the anatomic structure of those regions. And then we found that gray matter was not significantly different from the corona radiata, but that the corpus callosum was significantly less stiff.
Right.
Yeah. His is in vivo, and this is not. Yes, right.
And in the living brain in surgery, the bisensitive that the body brain is considered is pretty much too soft. So we can maybe get into living.
It seems like a hydration thing could have a major effect on the stiffness.
So these are all in a humidified chamber. So, yeah. Yes? Okay. So we find stiffness if we were to go, this is, we didn't actually test on the same brain, but just as a color depiction, basically increasing stiffness. So we find the least stiff would be in the corpus callosum, and I'm about to show you some data that, frankly, the very least stiff would be brainstem. Then corpus callosum, then we have corona radiata, and then we have the cortex. Oh, I'm sorry, and the stiffest would be in the thalamic gray matter. And so there are regional differences, and my father likes to say that people are either lumpers or splitters in life. People like to draw that everything's the same, or they like to say that everything's just a little bit different and highlight the differences. So when the differences between different regions are on the order of 20, 30, 50% differences in the stiffness of the region, some may say, oh, that's hardly any different. I'll just simplify it and say that the brain is uniform. But I think it's helpful to make a well-informed decision to approximate. There's a lot of previous data as well as current data. I just want to comment one thing about this plot, actually. So that our stiffness that we're measuring is a couple of orders less stiff than the stiffnesses that Dick had presented this morning. There are others who have presented stiffnesses in the range using similar, very high frequency, very, very low strain techniques. And in fact, let me go back one. Oops. Shuck and Advani, a very famous early paper from the early 70s, used very, very small strains and found stiffnesses on the order of what Dick was measuring, and that was dead pieces of tissue in shear stress, okay? So it wasn't at the same high frequencies, but it was also a very, very small strains. He used material at autopsy, so the fact that it wasn't living tissue and the time post-mortem is unknown, I've always been a little bit concerned about that. So I did want to talk for a moment here about pediatrics. So the infant tissue that we've measured is considerably stiffer, on the order of 2 times stiffer than the adult tissue in the pig. And that in the rat, it's also 2 times stiffer. We have a fair amount of tissue from cortex in the adult human. And then we have just 1 or 2 samples from kids who were about 3 years old, and they were also stiffer than the adult. And I've had neurosurgeons who've told me, no, no, I touch kid brains. They're definitely much, much softer than the adult. Infant brains are actually stiffer. So it's a higher water content. Mm-hmm. It is a higher water content, but it's much lower myelin content. And the myelin is much softer than the rest of the constituents of brain tissue. So this puzzled us early on, but it's been long enough since we had this, and it's very consistent and actually been confirmed by many other people that this is one of those. It could be a rate thing. It could be so your fingers are telling you one thing.
It hasn't been confirmed in living.
Yes. Okay.
But not children. One way that's proper.
Not living children, but young brains of animals.
Yes.
Yes.
One way that neurosurgeons, I think, judge how stiff things are is simply how it sucks.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it kind of goes, but we use a sucker. So it may be that the infant brain dissociates mm-hmm. more rapidly, but it's still stiff.
Right. So then we're concerned about this live-dead issue, right? Maybe the real living brain is highly pressurized, so we did an experiment now indenting the cerebral cortex of a living animal on a cortical surface, and let me just go over this one sec. So we had an indentation which was 3 millimeters per second, so it was, in my mind that's a little slow, but for your mind that's not so slow. The indenter was held for 90 seconds and then retracted. We did 6 indentations in a site to answer your question about whether or not the preconditioning made a difference. And then we would allow rest periods between each of these 6 indentations to study the tissue. And the procedure was, as I mentioned before, where we had in vivo testing, then we gave an overdose of sodium pentobarb to the animals, we did in situ testing, and then finally the brain was excised, placed on a lubricated surface, and then the indentation was repeated, and we call that in vitro testing. Each site was only used once. So if we indented 6 times, and then we found a neighbor right near that site and indent, so we would mark each site with a Sharpie marker and never indent in exactly the same site for the 3 parts of the test, but rather we indented in the same 5 millimeter diameter region, but not exactly on the same tissue. And so, as you might expect, an indentation, this is a force measurement, and this is over time, and when the animal is alive, you have heart rate superimposed on top of our force signal of the exposed brain. This is the respiration superimposed. What we did is we hyperventilated the animal. We basically paralyzed the animal so we could hyperventilate the animals, turned off the ventilator, took some initial transient measurements, ventilated them for a minute, and then turned off the ventilator again to get some steady state, used the information from the living brain here and here to do our fits for the data. And, of course, once the animal is sacrificed and the animal is just in situ, then what we have is a nice, easy curve to be able to fit. We used Lean Radix solution for a semi-infinite half space to back out the modulus based on the force that we were measuring and the indentation depth, the radius of the indenter, and that's considered, of course, the indenter is a rigid indenter. We have the first non-precondition and then finally the final, or the 6th cycle is here. So you can see that we reach steady state and reproducible, but the first indentation is not like the 6th indentation. And then we analyzed all of the data separately, indentation 1, indentation 2, and so no preconditioning is the first indentation. Preconditioned, we actually averaged together the last few indentations because it was very superimposable. And I've summarized the results. This is actually the long-term modulus, and I want to point out that the in situ is stiffer, significantly stiffer, whether preconditioned or not, to the in vitro. So both of them are dead. One of them is dead and in the skull, and the other is dead and out on a lubricated surface. The skull actually has, the container has an effect. So how big was our hole that we made? We made a very large hole that this indenter was going through. So it wasn't the fact that we were restricting there. This was the fact that the skull has some effect on the material properties. Instantaneous shear modulus had similar results. So basically, the conclusion of the live dead were that the shear moduli were consistently lower in vitro than they were in situ. Same boundary conditions exist, so for the in vivo and the in situ, whether the animal was living or just specially sacrificed, and there were no significant differences there. Preconditioning didn't seem to have a significant effect on the living brain, which was very interesting. So there may be a reperfusion. So the difference between the first and the sixth was not there in the living brain, but it was there in the dead brain. Okay, so preconditioning is an important consideration. Do we precondition or not for a dead brain? So we basically conclude from this that the mechanical behavior of the living brain in many respects is similar to the dead brain. The order of magnitude of the properties were the same, and I encourage you to take a look at the paper for the fine differences, because some things were different between the living and the dead brain, but in terms of the stiffness properties, the living brain was like an unpreconditioned dead excised brain. And for us, we wanted unpreconditioned properties. So it's important to take away from this that brain tissue is significantly nonlinear. It's inhomogeneous. Some white matter regions are also highly anisotropic. Infant tissue is different than adult tissue. You may need to consider living versus dead properties for your applications. For ours, that there were some aspects that we were comforted about by doing those experiments. Very quickly, I'd like to tell you about brainstem, which is highly anisotropic in its anatomic composition. And so in this case, we hypothesized that it was transversely isotropic, which is a lot like celery. But it has fibers going down the length of it, but if you go perpendicular to the fibers in either of the other two directions, that the properties would be equal. So we did a series of tests using the same device, but now starting at 50% and then decrementing and then going back up to 50%. We did two preconditioning runs and then took the third data. And that was basically because from the previous study we found that in dead tissue preconditioning made a difference, and we wanted to get consistent results for this particular purpose. And we also held that this 50% run had to have the same, not statistically significantly different results as the previous 50% run. And that actually eliminated a lot of tissue. And so I think that that's a very challenging but not so relevant for hydrocephalus condition. If my research was in hydrocephalus, I probably would never consider testing brain tissue up to 50%, because I don't think that brain tissue in hydrocephalus ever would see those sorts of very large deformations. But I wanted to present this because we used a different type of fitting. We actually fit parameters simultaneously at the 50% test data in all three directions using a genetic algorithm, which is one that Yoram Lanier at Technion in Israel had used before, where you basically try and fit a lot of data together simultaneously and then look at its robustness to be able to predict other strain magnitudes. So when we did that, we actually found that the transverse anisotropy was, we found that, but we ended up having to throw away a lot of tissue testing because it wasn't consistent enough. We needed to have that consistency. Interestingly, we found that the fiber stiffness at finite deformation, the fibers, we divided up into a fiber component and a matrix component. The fibers were 10 times stiffer than that matrix component in the brainstem, and that matrix component is very, very soft. It is, you know, a tenth, or actually a twentieth of the stiffness of other parts of the cerebrum. And this is important for me in brain injury, because especially with children, there's concern about brainstem injury, especially with shaken baby syndrome and things like that. So the fact that the most compliant brain tissue is in the brainstem actually points to the fact that this area may be a very vulnerable area, and one for us to look at. So that's enough about lots of different brain tissue properties. And very briefly, skull properties have a very significant difference. This is elastic modulus. We did three-point testing here on about 23 samples from children obtained at autopsy. These were parietal bone. We also did occipital bone. This is parietal bone data. The age of the children were anywhere from 26 weeks gestational age to about 6 months of age, with most of the data coming in the birth to 1 month of age. It's very valuable data. It's not easy to get infant tissue for testing, and what we expected to find is what was previously published by Wood in the early 70s, that adult skull is very rate dependent. And we found that infant skull is not rate dependent at all. So this is actually very protective for us adults, and the infant, so in impact situations, that's a very crucial. So the impact does not have a skull that stiffens at higher rates. And this is important for this group, this panel here. The elastic modulus of parietal bone is shown here, 250 megapascals. This is suture. So suture is far more elastic, and if you're thinking about your container, you might need to consider that the container is not entirely made of skull, but actually a significant suture component, and if hydrocephalus is accompanied by high intracranial pressure, that may be a factor that you need to take into effect. Briefly, boundary conditions. The boundary conditions between the brain and skull in modeling, certainly in inertial motion, very important. Is it a no-slip condition and the cortex has to move along with the skull? Is there a sliding? Is it a frictional boundary that up to a certain point it sticks and then it slides? Lots of possibilities there. And the number of computational modelers have done parametric studies, and they all show boundary conditions important. But the measurements of boundary conditions between brain and skull are few and far between. This is actually computational modelers. Long ago in 1944, and again in the 70s, a transparent calvarium was placed on animals' heads and then visualized, or actually in some cases high-speed flash x-ray was used with radioisotope in the contrast media in the vasculature, and high-speed x-ray was taken. Anyhow, visualizing qualitatively whether or not, when with sudden motions of the head, did the brain slip against the skull. And more recently, neutral density accelerometer targets were used in the skull, in the brain itself, and the measurements all demonstrate a high likelihood that the brain and skull are slipping at the vertex. But we were particularly interested in what's happening here at the foramen magnum. And this is actually probably an image I took at Mayo with Steve Reeder, and this is me. And this is me again, where at Penn we were looking at high resolution images where we were looking at static positioning. So we've done some dynamic studies to ask whether or not the brain actually is extruded through the foramen magnum during flexion and extension in human volunteers living, and also then we're asking questions about rotations of various brainstem structures and cerebellum with respect to the vertex of the skull, not the vertex, but the base of the skull. So what we did is we were interested in the role of tension, so in this case, extension and flexion, and in a prone positioning, we did flexion, and what role did that tension of the spinal cord play on the position of the brainstem relative to the base of the skull. And then we also made comparisons to evaluate if subjects that were in the same position but were flipped in terms of gravitational gradient, were there differences there. So we were asking what's most important in the position and the extrusion of the brain through the foramen magnum, and what's the how much of the brain actually is extruded through the foramen magnum. And the results are that the cerebellum rotates some with flexion and extension, but the brainstem itself doesn't rotate. But the brainstem significantly moves out of the foramen magnum during moderate neck flexion. We didn't force anybody to flex extensively, but they did have to hold the position for quite a while. They had to hold it for the scan of about 2 minutes. So we found about a millimeter displacement out of the foramen magnum. And what we concluded from all of this is that one should use a frictionless boundary condition between the brain and skull at the foramen magnum. And you shouldn't use a closed foramen magnum, but rather an open foramen magnum in finite element analyses. That would be important. So the container may not be as fixed, especially in a young child, but even in an adult, these were all adult studies. The foramen magnum does have some flow in and out. So basically, to conclude, you really need to think about what your particular conditions are for the models that you're developing. The approximations that you make in these computational models will dictate the kind of results that you're going to get, and the next step is really to get people talking to each other to really come up with some functional thresholds for predictions about the consequence of some of these increased stresses in the regions of the brain tissue. So I'd like to open up to questions, and or we could all go to coffee and ask me questions. Yes.
So we demonstrated the brain scan, and doing the measures in the